Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of the Fertility Answers podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Neil Chappell, reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, part of the Fertility Answers network. And I'm bringing yet another episode of our podcast to our library for hopefully everyone's benefit. I will say, as a preempt to this particular episode, this is probably going to be one of the more difficult ones that I'll do. The topic I'd like to tackle today is futility. When to decide to pivot, to move on from fertility treatments and look at other options outside of what we traditionally offer of inseminations, IVF, donor egg, donor sperm, gestational carrier surrogacy, and look beyond those. So obviously this is an incredibly difficult topic and one that I'm very sensitive to, because I do feel like it's our responsibility to be an advocate for the patient in their treatment and in their decision to end treatments. And that's a difficult conversation and difficult series of conversations. So I want to try and put some bullet points and some actionable items that I've learned and picked up along the way, and bring some research to the front about what has been shown along the way that may help patients with these incredibly challenging decisions. So one of my old mentors, when I first started out, said that there are three main drivers in all fertility decisions: faith, family, and finances. And I think that that is incredibly well summed up, in that your faith will dictate what you are and aren't comfortable with. Your family kind of stands for your support system, your idea of what your family goals are, and all the dynamics involved therein. And of course, finances also play an option in states that are insured or not insured, and people that have insurance or don't have insurance, and what is covered and what isn't covered, and how confusing that all can be. And I promise one day we'll do a podcast on fertility insurance do's and don'ts. But you know, again, when to stop a treatment is one of the toughest decisions I think there is. And so it's a decision that many patients struggle with. There's no really well-defined endpoint, because each time you try, that cycle could be the one. And the opportunity to roll the dice and be that one, even if it's, you know, a one in two chance or a one in a million chance, if you try, you have a chance. If you don't try, you don't have a chance. And so it's incredibly tempting to try that one more time, and it's incredibly defeating to decide that you're not going to try anymore. But we need perhaps some definitions to kind of have some boundaries on what we're talking about. And so the American Society of Reproductive Medicine has done some writing on this, and they define futile treatment, or treatment that is least likely to result in a positive outcome, futile as being a less than 1% chance of pregnancy, and very poor prognosis as being a 1% to 5% chance of pregnancy. And I'm going to stress an important caveat here. This is not based on egg reserve testing alone. I see a lot of patients come into clinic and say, I have a low AMH, therefore my chance of getting pregnant is low. That is not true. Your egg reserve alone has really not much at all to do with your fertility. And I think we need to probably devote a whole podcast on diminished ovarian reserve and how to think about that. But just because you have a low egg count does not mean that you are incapable of ovulating an egg and achieving a pregnancy, or achieving a pregnancy through something like donor egg or donor embryo. So this is not based on egg reserve testing alone. This is based on a number of factors that need to be considered when discussing your options for treatment with your physician. This is incredibly, exceptionally, and very just overly individualized. These conversations are based on one patient or one couple's specific factors that deal with their story, and that's where their prognosis comes from. And my patients have taught me a lot over the years. You can't put everybody in one particular column or one particular bowl. We've all been humbled by Mother Nature, and I have patients that have a very low prognosis, a very poor prognosis, and achieve a pregnancy with their first cycle or two, or with minimal intervention. And I have patients that I should never see based on their story on paper, and yet they're some of my more difficult patients. So you have to take everything with a grain of salt. And as the journey develops and the journey evolves, you'll learn more about who you are as a couple or who you are as a patient, and that will dictate your prognosis in future cycles. So someone that comes in and thinks they have one particular story, a cycle or two into treatment, if I'm seeing their treatment manifest in different ways than what I initially saw in our initial conversation, that warrants a sit down, that warrants a phone call and say, hey, when we first saw you, your ovaries said this, your sperm said this, but now that I'm seeing a month or two of treatment, you're behaving more like this. We have to kind of redirect and recalibrate our expectations, and that may affect which decisions you make going forward. That's a conversation that needs to be had. So very individualized, very treatment specific, and can evolve over the journey, of course. These decisions are not cold. They're not calculated, and they're not always rational. And so you really account for this in the conversations that you have. You have to account for the brain and the heart and the uterus and the ovaries and the sperm. For patients, I think that the most important tenet that oversees and overlays all ways that we care is going to be the respect for their reproductive autonomy. And what that means is we need to respect that patient, that person, that couple has a right to their reproductive desires. And you need to respect where they're coming from with their goals and try and meet them where they are. If they are coming to a realization that they're maybe not going to be able to reach their goals, that may induce a sense of failure, and that needs to be addressed. We take fertility very personally, and right or wrong, there are certainly valid reasons for patients feeling that way. But you know, when your arm breaks, you don't really feel like a failure because your arm broke. It's just the bone broke. Or when you get a cold, you're not necessarily a failure for contracting a virus. But when you have issues with fertility, even though it's a medical diagnosis, the same as a cold or a broken arm, there is an overlaid sense of failure there that is unique to our specialty and needs to be recognized and validated. And I think inside that feeling of failure, that there is an impetus for the desire to take that next step and go that next cycle, because you could be the one. And other drivers besides that sense of failure and in reaching and being towards your own reproductive autonomy goals, the culture from social media and big air quotes here, fertility experts that are not necessarily arguably fertility experts at all, because their training doesn't count for the board certified training of a reproductive endocrinologist. But these fertility experts that have that drink or that vitamin or that supplement or that candle or that practice or that timing that says, oh, this is how this works, they are major drivers of misinformation that make it very difficult for patients to take a breath and see their story clearly, and makes it more difficult to give up. And I see this very frequently in the blogs or the ads or the thing of where they advertise about the one. And what I mean by the one is everybody reads a story about the one who got pregnant, that had that patient that was 45 that got pregnant, or the patient that had no eggs and got pregnant, or the patient that failed 5 IVF cycles with this fertility doctor, but then took my supplement and got pregnant. Everybody has that one patient they talk about in their advertising. And this is a major red flag for me, and should be for anybody that's out there seeking valid scientific information. If you're reading about a patient testimonial, that is not enough evidence to build a foundation for your decision about what you should do in your own treatments. Everybody has patients that have done things that were remarkable or unexpected in both positive or negative ways. I have thousands of stories of patients that have done just a million different things. And I think that it's kind of in a way, a disservice to a patient that you're sitting across from saying, I have a patient that did this. That can help frame a conversation for a decision, but that's not what you should base your decisions on. So you want to know not what one patient did, but what 100 patients or 1,000 patients did that came before you, because that's really where the truth lies. The truth doesn't lie in one person doing something random. The truth lies in what the majority of patients that have your story wound up doing, because that's what statistically is likely to happen in your case. So be aware of the bias of the story of the one. That was kind of a little tangent, but I think it's really important. Finally, I think one other thing from a patient standpoint is have a sounding board and a support system in place. This helps you with your establishment of permission to move on when it's appropriate. your clinical team, your doctor, your nurses, your support there, but also friends and family and colleagues. And if you don't have someone that you can bounce ideas or bounce your journey off outside of even the clinical team, ask your clinic for resources. Where are their support groups? Where are their counselors? Where are their other people that I can reach out to for support outside of my family and friends that I can talk to about this to help make my own decisions? Your clinic should have those resources they can provide you. From a provider standpoint, you know, I think our goal is respecting patients' needs, because you're and that's beyond just like your medical needs, but your psychological needs and your holistic needs and your integrational needs, your support system needs. These are important to address. What are your goals? What are your expectations? And what are your actual needs? You figure out where those are, and then you see where those things can meet, like a Venn diagram. And then you see where those things are maybe not able to overlap each other very well, and then explain to the patient about where there's a disconnect and why, and what can be done to make that less of a disconnect versus what's going to be very, very difficult. If someone's had both of their fallopian tubes removed, then getting pregnant on their own is going to be highly unlikely, and they need to know that from the start. As kind of more an extreme example, I think doctors are really bad about focusing too much on just numbers and stats and protocols and not as much on the patient. So I try take that breath before walking into the room and remember that you're talking to more than just an IVF cycle or an IUI cycle or a donor egg or embryo cycle, but you're talking to a patient that's got, you know, more parts than a uterus and ovaries. Even though that's what I spent my life, you know, devoted to learning, you have to appreciate that there are other aspects of this patient's care that are going to impact their treatment and their experience through that treatment. And so doctors, we're calling each other to try and work better on that. Sorry for interrupting as much as we do. We are always conscious of the fact that sometimes it's easy to idealize the science. We've come so far in the 40 plus years that we've done IVF that we are making leaps and bounds discoveries, but this science is not perfect. It is no different than any other field of medicine. We have done copious amounts of research. We have a ton of data. We've learned a lot. We've come a long way. We are able to do amazing things on the embryology side and on the more clinical side, you know, both in front of and behind the lab's glass. But it's still a medical field, just like oncology, just like internal medicine, just like cardiology, just like nephrology. And what I tell patients is, if you present to your office with a sinus infection, they're going to prescribe you an antibiotic, right? That antibiotic may or may not cover whatever bug you've got. And so they prescribe the antibiotic and they wait 10 days. And if it's better, great. If it's not better, then they change the antibiotic or they change the course of treatment. IVF is no different. We know what we need to do. We enlist the first line standard of care. If it's successful, fantastic, you're graduated. If it's not, we have to change gears. We have to look at what worked and what didn't, why, and change gears. This isn't a perfect science. We do what we can based on the appropriate level of evidence. Now, that being said, you are your advocate and you feel free to ask any questions as to why, and we'll give you the studies and the research and the data that we have to support what we're doing and why. And that conversation should always happen. But it's not perfect science, and we don't know everything. And that's a frustrating part of our job, certainly. So I think at the end of the day, respecting the patient's needs and having an appropriate focus on standard of care and first-line treatments where appropriate and second-line treatments where appropriate as the patient's story and journey develops is integral. But we have to, while respecting patients' wishes, weigh risk and benefits. We have to define policies and appropriate guidelines for patients. And having those policies in place ahead of time helps your patients be informed. If I have a patient that comes to me that's beyond the age that the American Society of Reproductive Medicine recommends doing embryo transfers, then I have to tell them in that first meeting and say, I cannot ethically help you. This is against our, you know, national guidelines. And then talk to them about why, educate them on that process, but do not start workup or treatment knowing that you can't proceed any further. So having those defined policies in place makes it easier for your patients to be more accepting of their prognosis and then be able to move on to something else. In cases of a very difficult cause, very poor prognoses or other exceptions to some of the rules that may not be clearly outlined in policies, ethics committees can be very helpful. But the patient would obviously be fully informed of the entire process there. one other thing that I think is incumbent on us is when we're giving difficult news, you know, news of very poor prognosis or futile prognosis per the ASRM definitions, is being able to offer support systems, counseling, other resources and guidance is critically important. And something I've also found helpful as well is a second opinion. You know, I may say something and it's helpful to hear it from another person in maybe just different wording. And that may just resonate better. And so you need to respect that that patients may hear the same message different ways, depending on who's giving it. And so having that opportunity to have the conversation not once, but maybe twice could be reasonable. And so don't be afraid to ask for a second opinion. So from a patient perspective and from a provider perspective, these are the things that are kind of going through everybody's mind as we kind of wrestle and grapple with the decision to move on and move past active fertility treatments. Here are the kind of tangible tips that I've kind of gleaned from my years of when to give up. And I think one of the most important things is when you've given yourself permission, have a line in the sand. When I have a patient that has a more difficult prognosis, we talk about even at the first meeting, your chances of getting pregnant with IVF or this, your chances of getting pregnant with IUI or this, your chance to get pregnant with donor gametes, this, you know, what feels like something that makes sense to you, what feels like something that doesn't really jive with your faith, family, and finances. And, you know, you draw that line. Now that line is in the sand, it's not in concrete. So you can be forgiving of yourself if you want to change that line as you go through your journey, but you do so weighing the risk and benefits the whole time. The goal is to not look back on this time with difficulty or with regret, to say, I came, I saw, I gave it my best shot, and I did what I had to do to give myself this chance. And it wasn't in the cards. And so I'm moving on to the next chapter of my life. Having permission is probably one of the more important things that I see for patients, is saying, at what point do you say that you gave it your best shot? That's really the question that needs to be answered. One of the questions that I ask myself when I'm offering patients treatment is, are my treatment options any better than your chance of getting pregnant on your own? So from a patient perspective, you need to have permission to move on. From a provider perspective, I want to know that what I'm offering you is better than just getting pregnant on your own. Because if my treatments with IVF or inseminations or surgery or whatever are no better than what I know your baseline chance or pregnancy is month to month, then I have a really hard time providing treatment. And so I talk to folks about that. If I'm not adding benefit, if I'm not adding a percentage chance increase in pregnancy month to month, then that's where I really have trouble falling. Or, of course, the final thing is when the risk of treatment is just too high or the benefit is so low that the risk of treatment outweighs benefit. So in this case, perfect example, like I already mentioned, American Society of Reproductive Medicine does not really endorse embryo transfers in patients that are older than a certain age because the maternal risks in pregnancy become too high. So at that point, the risks are greater than the benefit, as an example. But my take-home message is, for the patient, have a support system. Recognize your feelings, recognize the emotions that are at play. It's complicated. So being able to kind of wrap your head and your heart around the things that you're feeling and reconciling those with your goals, being adaptable in both your journey as your prognosis changes with your journey and your quote unquote line in the sand. And the overarching, I guess, North Star is, what do I need to do to give myself permission that I gave this my best shot? And that is not a decision you should make in a silo. It's a decision you should make with your doctor, knowing your percentage chances of getting pregnant, not based on just one patient who did what or X or Y or Z, but based on what the real epidemiologic longitudinal research shows in your case and what you're comfortable with based on your faith, family, and finances. And for providers, we want to make sure that we're actually adding an ad. We're actually adding a service or offering a service or offering a treatment or intervention that actually increases your chances of getting pregnant month to month without increasing your risks in that pregnancy or your risk to your life in general. So that's kind of how I frame most of those conversations on the unfortunate instances that I need to have those difficult conversations. And they're, like I said, already 8 or 9 times. So sorry for being a broken record, but they're difficult, but they are exceptionally important because our mandate in fertility medicine is being an advocate for patients' infertility journey. I'm blessed that most of the time that results in pregnancy, but sometimes it results in patients having to change their goals, change their desires, change what they're shooting for, and helping folks navigate that is our calling, and we need to take that with a great shoulder of responsibility. So I hope that this has been a helpful podcast. It took me a long time to draw up and write, because it's a very difficult topic, as I've now said 13 times, but it's important. So I hope this has been helpful for some. I look forward to bringing you guys more content in the coming weeks. Until then, as always, feel free to email us at podcast@fertilityanswers.com with any suggestions, comments, thoughts, concerns, or anything. We're very receptive to any and all feedback, and I will see you guys again soon. Thank you.